Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, episode 143, the sponsor showcase with Brenda Cooper and Amazon 47 North. This episode is brought to you by the Techno Thriller Tag by Simon Royal and by the space opera The Worker Prince by Brian Thomas Schmidt.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell.
This is Moses Sirigar.
And this is Brent Bowen.
And Moses is not on his cell phone, but he's still chilling at Starbucks in Hawaii, still joining the podcast.
Yeah, very Hawaiian here at the Starbucks.
Yeah, talk about soaking in the local culture, huh, buddy?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's some hula going on back here, and someone's like picking a coconut off a tree. And, nah.
Do they have coconut lattes over there?
That sounds good. I don't know about that. I'm just getting my standard chai, so.
Yeah, I think at least the Starbucks in Hawaii have their own blend of coffee that they serve there, I think. I think they have some kind of Kona blend that they do that you can't get in the other states, if I remember correctly. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, we do have a lot to get to today. We're going to reveal a new segment, maybe two new segments if time permits tonight. We'll see about that. We will definitely speak with Brenda Cooper, author of Maya in December and the new sponsor showcase. But first, a little bit of news that we want to talk about. And this was just released today. Unfortunately, this podcast won't be released until the weekend, so we won't look like we're quite on top of things as we are. But all of you know, we're recording this on Tuesday. Amazon announced today the launch of 47 North, the seventh imprint from Amazon Publishing, focusing on science fiction, fantasy, and horror. 47 North launches with 15 books, including the how do you guys say that?
Mongoliad.
I was getting the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable. book one, the first in an ambitious five-book collaborative The first in an ambitious five-book collaborative four-world series led by Neal Stephenson and Greg Bear. Those are two big names to start your imprint off with. All of these books will be available to English readers in Kindle, print, and audio formats at Amazon.com, as well as at national and independent booksellers. 47 North will publish original and previously published works, as well as out-of-print books. One more paragraph from their website. Amazon customers have a huge appetite for science fiction, fantasy, and horror books, and we are thrilled to have the opportunity to introduce readers to new and established voices in these genres, says Victoria Griffith, publisher, Amazon Publishing West Coast Group. We are especially happy to have a diverse list at launch and look forward to publishing across a wide range of subgenres. Some of their opening titles include Further Beyond the Threshold by Chris Roberson, or is it Roberson? Nightfall by best-selling UK author Stephen Leather, Against the Light by Dave Duncan, and Unspeakable Things from B.B. Larson. Well, guys, you know, Brent, we had Toby on not that long ago, and he expressed concerns about how much power Amazon has over publishing. And here they are, 2 weeks later, launching their own science fiction imprint, their seventh imprint, actually. What are your thoughts? Let's talk about this.
Well, from the power standpoint, that it's pretty scary. As I was looking online, I saw a couple places that cited that you guys may remember. Oh, it was about a month or two ago that there was a launch of fantasy and science fiction magazine, some free versions of that, and they thought that was what was the blog in particular? The blog was the blog was paidcontent.org, which tracks the economics of digital content. And they were citing and talking about offering fantasy and science fiction magazine up to subscribers or get the subscription information to determine whether this imprint would be viable, and using that as a testbed to figure out what kind of interest would be there, which was rather interesting. So just the pull that Amazon has in that regard. That the other thing that I thought was interesting, Sean, that you talked about, not so much from a power standpoint, but it'll be interesting to see how this thing plays out, is the fact that national and independent booksellers are going to look to help further Amazon in the distribution of this imprint. I know pretty much without even looking at the owner's Twitter feed, but our local independent, I should maybe even try to get him on the show to talk about this issue. But it would be really interesting to hear what he has to say. I imagine we would have our first hate segment. I seriously doubt that he would put any of the Amazon imprints on his shelves. Mm. So it'll be where I know one of the issues people have been talking about online, and I know we have it set for discussion, is the concern about Amazon certainly favoring, from a marketing standpoint, their own imprint. But I know from the other distribution standpoint, I have a hard time believing that honestly you're going to have a large contingent of national and independent booksellers picking up the imprint. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. As a matter of fact, I think I'll stop by the shop. It's not too far from my work, and maybe just poke around and ask a few questions. But hopefully I won't have anything thrown at me. But that's kind of my initial impressions in hearing this. Obviously, it's not a surprise. It's the seventh imprint, but. Yeah. A lot to consider there.
Yeah, I think Barnes & Noble and Amazon had a little tussle over this because Barnes & Noble didn't want to stock Amazon books, as you might imagine, but Amazon wanted certain ebooks. Generally, in their product lines, their initial idea was that they had an exclusive ebook relationship with the authors. So I think Amazon had to capitulate and let Barnes & Noble carry. Sell some of their books for their Nook. And then Barnes & Noble said, okay, well, then we'll stock your book. So I think they worked some of that out. But then there's still some questions about that ongoing. So that is going to be very interesting to watch, like Brent said. But I definitely look at this as kind of a glass half full situation, because there's another publisher of science fiction, fantasy, and horror out there who is, acquiring titles right now. Any of the authors I've talked to who work with Amazon on whether it's Amazon Encore or Thomas and Mercer, which is their thriller imprint, the authors praise working with Amazon and say it's unlike working with a regular publisher, because they actually treat you like a regular human being. And not that all publishers don't. There are great science fiction fantasy publishers, especially some of the smaller ones. But generally in publishing, you're not consulted about marketing and your cover and things like that. And Amazon, a lot of people I've talked to, Amazon makes a much bigger effort to let the author have input in the process than the same authors got with other major publishers. So generally, the satisfaction rate is extremely high among the authors who have worked with Amazon directly. Amazon gets the books out faster. They let the people have more input on like the pricing of the ebooks even. It's more like a partnership, which is kind of how it should be, I think. So if you're wanting to get published, I think this is fantastic, because there's another publisher out there who might pick up your books. They're also – Amazon is forcing the publishers to treat their authors better, because Amazon's offering better customer service in that sense to their authors. So I think this is great in that respect. I looked at the selections, the initial offerings for 47 North. 47 North, by the way, is the latitude of Seattle, which is where Amazon is based, apparently, or at least this division is based. I found it interesting that there wasn't a traditional fantasy offering in the list. There isn't like an epic high fantasy type of offering. There is some military sci-fi and space-oriented science fiction. So that was good to see. And I'm actually reminded of something that Lou Anders said at Dragon Con, which is that he found that in ebook format that they generally got better sales for their sci-fi titles than their fantasy titles. And he had wondered out loud, if is it because you know, the sci-fi crowd is more likely to be an early adopter of ebook technology, and the fantasy audience is, you know, is not more traditional or something like that. So I thought it was very interesting that Amazon didn't come out with, you know, a great big epic fantasy. This Mongoliad is more of a historical fantasy type of thing. It's something about, like, the characters start some sort of Western martial arts, and they use that to go, like, stop the Mongols from coming into Europe or something along those lines. So it's kind of a funky mashup thing like that. But otherwise, you read the list, and it sounds almost like a list of, like, suspenseful, action-packed thriller-type novels.
Yeah, I noticed that, too.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting, and I almost wondered if are these, like, some of the almost books that almost made it into Thomas and Mercer, which is their thriller imprint, and they're like, well, it's too just too fantasy or too sci-fi. Let's toss it over to this new one. Maybe in the future, the offerings will be a little bit more traditional in terms of fantasy, or at least there'll be some of those. I don't know. There is one that sounds a little humorous, but otherwise it has that kind of action-packed thriller type of sound to most of these. Two of these were indie books. B.V. Larson is, like, super prolific indie author, does really, really well. He was picked up. He's doing an urban fantasy with these guys, so that's interesting. Evan Curry has one of the military sci-fi novels. But he was independently published. You know, he just did his own e-books, and he got picked up here. Other than that, there are some traditional authors, traditionally published authors previously. I think there's the reprint in there of Resurrection. And so the initial offerings were a little surprising to some of the indie authors I talked to today, because they thought, oh, we thought you guys were going to gobble up more indies. And maybe they will in the future, you know, but so far they've only done...
Yeah, that was my thought on that, is they have... You know, they get to see very, very quickly which independent author is doing really well. And they'll be in a position to really jump and offer a deal to those folks. I mean, after all, if, you know, Moses, when you start selling 1,000 copies a month, and they're saying, man, we're not making very much money off of that book Moses is selling. Well, if we publish him, we can sell more copies, and Moses will still make more money because he'll be selling more, but we'll be making more too because now we're the publisher. So I started to wonder, was that a little bit of a conflict of interest? I mean, not really, but you know what I mean? Because it's like they could look at that and say, we're not making hardly anything on this. How can we make more money off of it? I guess maybe I'm being a little cynical.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because they have access to all sorts of statistics. They can tell how many people clicked on your book's page, how many people have read your sample, how far they get in your sample. I mean, they probably have stats that tells them when people buy your book, do they finish it? How quickly do they read it? You know, like, it's that part is a little creepy.
But, that is creepy. Yeah.
But I hope they get some good stats on my book because, you know, frankly, I'd love to be, you know, one of their epic fantasy authors writing a big series for them. I think that would be great because of everything I've heard about how great Amazon has been with their authors. So
you're gonna say it'd be epic, huh? I heard it. I heard you.
Wait, what did I say?
You said, I want to be writing the big epic fantasy series. That would be, and then it sounded like you were going to say epic.
Oh, yeah. No, I would love, they're one of the two or three or four publishers I would love to get picked up by. But they have like 9 offerings initially. Some of these are like series, so there's going to be more than one book in that group, like that Mongoliad, for example. But there's 9 different categories here, and 2 of the 9 already, you know, are independent. But it's interesting because it shows that they're open to picking up just about anything here. They'll pick up, you know, an established author. They'll reprint books from, you know, maybe some backlist books. They're open to doing a lot of different things. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, they're not worried about picking up a series that another publisher left off with because you can still buy those series right there on Amazon. So they're getting whatever they get for that. And then, you know, so their concerns are different than a traditional publisher would be, I would think.
Yeah, and they love to pick up stuff that's already been out there, which is unusual. And they'll repackage it, give it a new cover. They'll give it some new editing. They've been doing this sort of thing with the Amazon Encore program for quite a while, but that's where they pick up, you know, indie books and then they repackage them. That's a little different, arguably.
Or out-of-print titles. Yeah, the out-of-print stuff has been good for them to pick up.
Yep. There's no head editor that's been announced for this yet, apparently, which might show in the offerings. Because the offerings, we said there's sort of a suspenseful theme to them, but they're kind of all over the place, and it'll be interesting to see if they streamline this a little more. Because like when Thomas and Mercer came out, they picked up and snatched up some of the best-selling indie thriller writers and, you know, repackaged them and sent them back out into the world. Here it's a little bit of everything, and maybe there will be a head editor announced at some point who will get a better sense of like giving a definition to this offering. But for right now, they're actually advertising that they're just offering a wide array, this is a direct quote, a wide array of new novels and cult favorites, from urban fantasies to space operas, alternate histories to gothic and supernatural horror. So as of now, they're just sort of like a little bit of everything.
Sounds like the kids showed up behind you there.
Oh, did they?
<Uh-oh>. No, it's all right. No. It's local color. We have some Hawaii on the podcast. You know, Brent, I want to go back to what you mentioned at the beginning, the idea of bookstores not carrying these titles. It seems to me that on some level I can understand that, but if you have a book that's popular and that people want, you're kind of cutting off your nose there when you could be selling it yourself. So that's going to be interesting to see if this Mongoloid does really well. Or did I say that right? My goodness.
Oh, Mongoliad.
Mongoliad. Man, I'm having a hard time with that one. I'm not reading that book. It seems like people would want to pick that up because, you know, why buy it at Amazon if they could buy it there?
Certainly. Yeah, I mean, that would be the risk right. that the indies would take. But they've been known to take those kinds of risks before. And kind of close and shutter the doors and close those folks out. I could see them organizing on this particular topic. There's a lot of passion around around in that industry in particular, that segment of the industry in particular around Amazon.
I know, it's funny, all the angst about Barnes & Noble and Borders, and you know, Borders is gone now, but Amazon has a lot more power, it seems to me, than they ever did.
Yeah, I think Amazon's really the big competitor now in that regard. And you know, Moses, it was fascinating. You were talking about the couple independent or the couple self-published authors that were picked up. Were those some of the higher selling authors?
Yes. B.B. Larson, for sure. He's written everything from epic fantasy to just military sci-fi stuff. And he's so prolific and he sells very well. The other guy, Evan Curry, I wasn't familiar with him at first, but I just researched him a little bit today, and it turns out his book and he has more than one actually, they've been selling quite well, not super well, but quite well. So that was, you know, another thing I noticed, that so far with these bigger imprints that Amazon has, they seem to be, when they pick up independent self-published authors, they do tend to pick ones that are already selling well.
Well, I was just curious because when you're talking about the glasses being half full and with the potential glut you could see of self-published titles being out there, is, you know, is there an opportunity for this imprint to potentially pull, you know, something that's a gem that might be there, but maybe potentially not selling well, but based on all the other factors that you mentioned that Amazon can get a hold of with respect to, you know, how quickly somebody's getting through the book, the ratings, everything else, is they may not have the total purchases. They would be in a position to kind of lift up, if you will, or kind of promote some of the underappreciated self-published titles and really give those self-published titles the marketing push. They may be able to reward quality, I guess is what I'm saying.
I hope so, you know, and they do have editors reading books. You know, they have people who are looking at books that are selling or sort of selling and checking them out. I really hope that does happen because there are some people out there who are not good at the marketing and promotion and all that business. You would hope that they're not just picking out the easy books that are selling, but that they're finding some of the hidden gems in the rough out there too.
Wait a minute. You guys want them to actually do the job of a publisher? Oh, come on. No one does that anymore, except for Lou.
Maybe Lou.
Well, there's so much to talk about on this topic. We should probably continue this another time, though, if there's more to discuss here, as we're coming up on 20 minutes already. But, you know, folks, we would love to hear your thoughts on 47 North as well. Please call our voicemail line or send us an email, and we'll get it on the show. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with the sponsor showcase with Brenda Cooper. The This episode is brought to you today by The Worker Prince, the new science fiction novel from Brian Thomas Schmidt. What if everything you thought you knew about yourself and the world turned out to be wrong? For Davy Ree, Prince of the Boralian people, that nightmare has become a reality. Freshly graduated from the prestigious Boralian Military Academy, now he's discovered he was secretly adopted and born a worker, ancient enemies of the Boralians, enslaved now for generations. The workers, the virtuous, live lives harder than Davy has ever imagined. To make matters worse, Davy's discovered that the High Lord Counselor of the Alliance, his uncle, is responsible for years of abuse and suppression against the workers Davy now knows as his own people. His quest to rediscover himself brings him into conflict with his friends and family, calling into question his cultural values and assumptions, and putting in jeopardy all he's worked for. Davy's never felt more confused and alone. Will he stand by and watch the workers face continued mistreatment, or turn his back on his loved ones and fight for what's right? Whatever he decides is sure to change his life forever. The Worker Prince is the new science fiction novel from Brian Thomas Schmidt, creator of the Twitter interview series SFF Writer Chat. To learn more about the novel that has been praised by Redstone SF, Brenda Cooper, and David Lee Summers, visit brianthomasschmidt.net or use the image you'll find on our website, which will take you to the very affordable ebook edition. Paperbacks are also available, of course. And you can listen to our interview with Brian in episode 136, The Worker Prince, by Brian Thomas Schmidt.
I'm Brandon Sanderson.
I'm Dan Wells.
And I'm Howard Taylor. And you are listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Joining us for the first installment of the sponsor showcase is Brenda Cooper, author of Mayan December, The Silver Ship in the Sea, and Reading the Wind, among other titles. Welcome to the showcase, Brenda.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about Mayan December here. It's a bit of a departure from your previous novels. Can you tell us a little bit about the story?
I wrote Mayan December kind of because I had to. Sometimes a story just sort of comes up and says, write me. And so even though it's not my normal sort of harder science fiction, I just went ahead and did it. It's set in the Yucatan Peninsula, which I absolutely love. It's set around the end of the Mayan calendar, but it is neither a sort of new age, we all go off and everything's happy book, nor is it an apocalyptic book. And to me, I just wanted to do something that dealt with both the older Mayan culture and with our current times. And so there's a little bit of science fiction in there, a lot of stuff that feels an awful lot like fantasy. I'll call it sort of historical fantasy, set in about 970 AD. And it was awfully fun to write, and I hope people are enjoying reading it.
I know there's a time travel element to this. Do you approach that as a science fictional time travel or a fantastic time travel?
Probably a fantastic time travel because I don't really explain how it happens.
Okay.
It's kind of magic.
You mentioned what the book isn't, and that's interesting because I think with the movie that came out 2012 and all this talk about the end of the world, December 2012, the Mayan calendar, that's probably something that you and your publisher had to be a little concerned with.
You know, you're right. It's pretty interesting. I probably do describe it that way a little bit. I could tell you what the book is. It's a little bit of a romance and a little bit of a mystery and a family story, and has a little bit about stars and jaguars in it.
Nice. Well, this whole common understanding, I guess you put it, of the Mayan calendar predicting something catastrophic in December of 2012. In your research of this novel, what did you discover about that event and sort of the common either correct assumptions or misconceptions of 2012?
The Mayan calendar does, in fact, not go past that in any place where people have seen it inscribed. There really does not appear to be a great, big, huge Mayan belief that the world is going to end. They seem to believe a little bit more like the Hindus, that the world moves in cycles. Their whole calendar is set up in circles and cycles, and it's almost like gears that turn inside of each other in order to describe the passage of time. So their belief is, I guess, a little less linear than our Western belief. And they seem to describe and to say that we are maybe just coming into a new time, but even when you talk to today's Mayan elders or listen to videos on YouTube from today's Mayan elders, they're not talking about something that happened so that one day is entirely different from the others. It's not a singularity event, maybe is a way to put that. And America seems more obsessed with it than anybody else. America seems more obsessed with the date, actually, than Mayans do.
Why do you think that is, that Americans seem to be the most obsessed with it?
I think we've always been kind of obsessed with apocalypse. Maybe that's even the Western thinking, because in our Western Judeo-Christian traditional thinking, there's always, you know, sort of the end of the world, the book of Revelation, everything is going to end, you know, time has a beginning and an ending. And so I think maybe that's part of how we think. Most of the sort of New Age books were also written by Americans who went down there and have studied with the Mayans, but came up with these sort of beliefs. And many of them are really interesting, and it would be all right. In fact, if some of them came true, they're not bad things, but I'm not so sure that they will.
So what you're saying then is that the Mayan calendar, you said it turns like gears. It's either like the Wheel of Time or steampunk. That's
This is not steampunk. I do have a story, a steampunk story set in the same place but a different time, oddly enough. But Mayan December is definitely not steampunk, and I'm pretty sure the calendar is not steampunk either. It really is a pretty basic belief-based belief is the wrong word. The Mayans were very scientific, and they built a number of their pyramids and things really to line up with astronomical events.
You said this was a book that just had to be written. Is that because of your interest in Mayan culture, or is there another aspect of the story that was calling to you?
Both. I think a lot of it was both Mayan culture and just the place. You know how sometimes a place just is super attractive to somebody? There are certain places that just are lovely. And for different people, they're different. Like for me, I love Mount Shasta. I love the Grand Tetons. And I love the Yucatan Peninsula. I really don't know why. I just know that I feel very much at home there, and that I find it just breathtakingly beautiful. So I wanted to write things set there. And the big idea around this story, and I talked about this a little bit on John Scalzi's The Big Idea, was that we tend to get so wrapped up in science and so wrapped up in our daily world, especially if you're sort of a computer geek, which is what I am, that I think we forget that there really is magic in the world. And I do believe that there is at some level. There are things that happen that just seem too good to be true, too odd to be true, too synchronistic to be true. And we often shut ourselves out from that because we're so busy only believing things that are always repeatedly verifiable, if you will. And so part of the core of the story is what happens when this woman scientist who goes down there to give talks and share with the world a lot of the research she's been doing on this time and this culture. She's an archaeoastronomer, which means someone who studies the astronomy of ancient people. So she goes down there in December of 2012 to do this professional thing. She does not believe in magic. She doesn't believe in anything other than science and verifiable, repeatable science. And then her daughter disappears into the Mayan jungle and comes back with artifacts she can't possibly have. And I don't want to say much more. It ends up being spoilers. But some of it is about how does Alice, the scientist, have to confront the idea that maybe there are dimensions to the world that aren't put just in science and day-to-day things.
Well, I know that the book is hard to put down, as you saw on Twitter. My wife read it and really loved it. In fact, I'm going to bring her on the show to talk about it and why she liked it so much. So you want to keep your ears open for that. An irony, perhaps, is that, you know, you're a futurist writing a book about the past. And this got me wondering, you know, how much do futurists study history as they're looking at the ways humanity may change in the future?
Oh, tons. I think you have to, because we make a lot of the same mistakes over and over again. In fact, we're really good at that as a species. And we can also learn what we don't want to do by looking back at the past. And science fiction writers have done this forever. Look at 1984 and Fahrenheit 451. And I mean, there's tons in Brave New World. There's tons of books that have basically looked at things that were going on now, put them off into the future and made them into warnings in order to warn us of the things that we probably shouldn't be doing. fact, science fiction, I think, is almost supposed to be subversive at some level.
Yeah, I think it was Ray Bradbury who said that one of his jobs when you write science fiction is to try to prevent the future.
Oh, that's great. I haven't heard it worded that way. I heard Ursula Le Guin say something once about how it was important to include social commentary when you're thinking about science fiction on the whole, that one of a science fiction writer's job is to, or one of the beauties of science fiction is that you can use it to make social commentary in a way that you really can't use any other genre.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's and Left Hand of Darkness is a great example of that too. One of the things I was always curious about since we're kind of on the topic a little bit, futurist thinking, and I'm sure there's different types of futurists and futurism. And I mean, is it normally looking at how technology is going to change humankind, or is it just looking at the changes in humanity in general?
Oh, it's vast. Yeah. Your initial thought on that was, I mean, there are futurists that are so narrow and so deep that they maybe are looking just at the future of a particular technology, the future of oil, the future of mining, future of transportation, future of smart grid. I mean, I know some brilliant people working in all of those areas. I'm more of a generalist, and I tend to talk to business audiences that are more generalist and talk about a combination of technology and then the kinds of things that you know are happening. I mean, there are trends like aging populations, population growth, those sorts of things that we have to think about, you know, that are pretty certain. And of course, the most interesting part is the uncertain part, and that's pretty hard to talk about, but it's fun.
Yeah, that's where the speculation comes in. That's what science fiction writers are for. The Silver Ship in the Sea series, it was published through Tor, and Mayan December is coming out through Prime Books. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between working with a larger press for the Silver Ship series and then a smaller press for this book?
A little bit. I really have enjoyed being with both publishers. I'm a fairly small fish for Tor, and I think they were giving me a chance as a new writer. I got great response from their publicity department, their the people who do the book design and things like that. Super support on the book, really, from Tor all the way through. The series did fairly well. It's still selling. But this is a very hard time, both for publishers to bet on midlist writers. Toby Bukel was on your podcast, I think, talking about this with his Kickstarter project. And so Mayan December found a home not at Tor, but with Prime, who is a smaller publisher. They're not a small press. They're larger than that. They put out a pretty decent number of books and have regular distribution. And Sean does a fabulous job of, I think, of supporting his authors and doing things. And I've had a completely wonderful experience with Prime from the very beginning. So I've been quite happy that this book ended up there. So hopefully I'll be able to write more books for both publishers in the future.
Yeah. Awesome. Is Mayan December going to be a standalone novel, or do you have any other works planned with those characters?
Neither.
Neither. Oh, okay. Explain.
I would like to write more of the same kind of books where I get to explore a new place and a new idea and explore some of the ancient magic of a culture, if you will, and what is happening for that culture currently. Two of the ideas for places I'd like to set other books are Thailand and Australia, and neither of them would have the same characters. I think Mayan December is finished as a story, and of course it'd be too late now to write something and get it published and read before the end of the Mayan calendar anyway, even if I wanted to do more with it. But I really feel like it was a complete story in its own.
Well, that's great. That's a nice little niche to be able to carve out there. Do you still want to write your hard science fiction also?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm currently working on a YA near future hard science fiction that I'm really liking, and it's sort of in the final edit stages. The next book I'm going to write is the fourth one in the Silver Ship in the Sea series. They've been sold to Germany. It seems that they're doing all right in Germany, and Germany may want to buy the fourth book. That's my hope. And regardless, I may end up having to put it out myself here, but I have a lot of readers who keep asking for it. So And I want to finish it. I feel like, you know, the fourth book is the last book. It's always been a four-book series, so I'm going to finish that. And I have one other hard science fiction series that we're marketing right now. So I actually hope to do both.
Oh, that's great. And I know Toby was doing the same thing. You know, he has an audience who wants the rest of his series. And the great thing about these changes in publishing is that authors can do that. You have an established audience already. Would you do that through a Kickstarter campaign also, or would you just go ahead and put it out as an ebook?
I don't know. Unlike Toby, I have a day job that pays the mortgage. So it seems for me, I don't really need the advance in order to have the money to do it. So I probably wouldn't do it as a Kickstarter. But the nice thing about the Kickstarter project is it kind of gets people excited about the book coming out and lets people know about it and things like that. So I guess I'm not entirely decided yet whether to do it that way or not. But I kind of feel like it would be better to just write it and put it out. But then, of course, I have to figure out, well, how do I get publicity for it so people know it's there?
Right, right. Well, obviously you have a website, brenda-cooper.com. Do you have any sort of newsletter or anything like that that readers could sign up for?
I don't have a regular newsletter. I'd love to have people follow me on Twitter. That's Brenda Cooper. I do a monthly column that goes over at Futurismic, which is really fun, and that's where some of my futurist stuff goes. And I'd love to have people go read that. It's called Today's Tomorrows, and it if they just, you know, go search for that or just go look in the columns area on Futurismic, that comes up. I do blog regularly on my website, and people can follow me with an RSS feed there. So lots of ways.
Brenda, it's been great having you in the showcase. Is there anything else about the book that you wanted to mention that we didn't talk about?
No, I don't think so. I just, you know, I really hope that people enjoy it. And I really enjoyed sponsoring Adventures in Science Fiction Publishing. I think you do a great podcast.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. And thank you for listening for all these years and supporting us. And folks, Mayan December rated very highly in the Feral household. So please come to adventuresinscifipublishing.com. You can click on the image for Mayan December and it'll open straight to the Amazon page, or go to your local bookstore. That's a good thing to do. Brenda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Three, 15, 21, 10. 9 billion people on Earth, 6.5 billion about to die. In the wake of arbitrator Jonah Oliver's interrogation of a prisoner of Oonpol, his secure life disintegrates into one of lies, corruption, conspiracy, and murder. Jonah is thrown into a race against the clock to stop a plot designed to eliminate two-thirds of the population. He soon finds his past is not what he thought it was. Those closest to him cannot be trusted, and what he's learned could get him, or worse, his loved ones killed. From a world where personal privacy has been forsaken comes a tale of conspiracy, love, murder, and the bond shared by brothers. Tag is a new techno thriller from Simon Royal, and Royal is spelled R-O-Y-L-E. Written in the vein of 1984, Tag is an exciting debut from a new author. So if you enjoy Utopian Societies Gone Wrong, you need to give Tag a look. Also, as a nice twist, I think it's a nice twist, most of the novel is set in Singapore, or New Singapore, as it's called in the novel. Personally, I know I love Earth-based novels, but I really love it when those novels don't use kind of the standard setting. So something I'm a little less familiar with is great. Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com and click on the image for Tag by Simon Royal. And also, you can follow Simon on Twitter. His handle there is at S-G-R-O-Y-L-E. And of course, I'll put that link in the show notes for this episode, so please come find it there. And when you give him a follow, let him know that we sent you. For great interviews with other authors, visit www.simon-royal.com. We have a little bit of feedback to get to concerning manly vampires. First, I got an email from Lou. We were talking about Vampire Empire, which is one that he published, and he wanted to make sure we knew about Jasper Kent's book, 12, also. I'm looking for it. Up there. Where is it? I want to make sure I got the title right. Oh, there it is. Yeah, 12, and I think it's 13 years later. So he's all very manly, lots of blood, no romance. So there's another recommendation for manly vampires.
Okay. And we're going to put a link in the show notes. Check this one out. I started a thread at Kindle Boards last week saying, hey, can you guys recommend some manly vampires and good historical fantasy fiction stuff? And we got quite a few, you know, answers from some real hardcore readers that came up with a lot of good suggestions. So there you go. Check that out in the show notes.
That's going to do it for this episode. We do want to remind you to enter the Worker Prince book giveaway contest. Call the voicemail line at 619-752-4737 to leave your take, your impression of a Wookiee. We'll play all of them on the show, and Brian, the author of TWP, I guess we've adopted that as the quick handle on that, we'll pick a winner.
We want you guys to come by the website too. We have a new book review of Ready Player One. It's a novel by Ernest Klein, reviewed by our very own Matt Hughes.
And congrats to Barbara and Camille for winning the Brenda Cooper contest. Signed books are in the mail to both of you, so make sure you're checking the mailbox. Well, by the time this episode goes out, you should have them already. If you haven't joined us on Facebook or Twitter yet, please do. That's where you can play along in a lot of these contests and win some books, except for the Wookiee one. And we need some Wookiee impressions, so please call. but, you know, Twitter especially, it seems to be more active. There's a lot going on there, so join us there. Thank you for listening, everyone. Please support the show by supporting our sponsors. We appreciate that. And we'll see you all real soon.
Aloha.
Take care.
Please visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more. And email us at AdventuresInSciFiPublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at MusicAlley.com. No offers were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.
I was honestly just trying to keep from burping into the microphone.
Oh, I'm recording, so that's going on the blooper at the end of the show.